Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I am your host, Andrew Swetman, and today I'm bringing you two new movie reviews, a film festival recap, and a rundown of some of the other things I've been watching lately. Plus, I continue the new series, The Art of Deconstruction, Faith, Doubt, and Film. This time, my friend Chad Hill stopped by to talk about the Martin Scorsese missionary epic, Silence. Stay tuned.
Years since our first run together. 1900 and nothing.
It's a long time.
What you doing?
Getting mixed up with her.
You are marvelous, Rose. We were married Sunday.
Little lady made these.
I did, sir.
Well, Brother Phil?
Open up the gate, let him out.
You sure he's not ready?
Go on, let him out.
He's just a man, Peter. Only another man.
Do you ever feel empathy for someone when you really didn't want to? Maybe in an argument with someone you really dislike, you begin to see things from their side, and you know that's a healthy response, but it's also just annoying. You think things like, I didn't want to like this person. I was perfectly happy villainizing them. That's how I felt watching the new film, The Power of the Dog. This film is written and directed by Jane Campion and stars Benedict Cumberbatch, and it's a really odd but fascinating Western set in 1925 Montana that looks at gender and family dynamics and features some very strong performances. This is the time of the year when people start talking about Oscar buzz, especially when a prominent actor has a big role in something. I'm certainly no expert on such things, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if Benedict's performance in this film wins some awards down the road. Benedict Cumberbatch plays Phil, a rough and tough cowboy who is a huge jerk to everyone around him, especially people he sees as weak. Phil and his brother George run a ranch in Montana. George, played by Jesse Plemons, takes an interest early in the film in an innkeeper named Rose, played by his real-life romantic partner, Kirsten Dunst. Rose is a widow, and she and her son Peter run the inn and restaurant together. The son character Peter is really fascinating. He's quiet and sensitive, and when we first see him in the film, he's creating floral bouquets out of paper. A few scenes later, when he meets mean and macho Phil as a patron in the restaurant, it doesn't go well. Phil belittles him, mocks the fact that Peter speaks with a lisp, and burns the flowers Peter had used to decorate the table. As the story progresses, it becomes almost a deconstruction of Phil's cruel personality, and we slowly begin to understand why he is the way he is. Phil can't stand people around him being happy, so when his brother George announces his intention to marry Rose, he lashes out and makes life miserable for Rose and Peter after they move in to the family's home on the cattle ranch. The most fascinating thing about The Power of the Dog for me is the way it looks at gender in an environment that does not value softness. Phil never allows himself to be vulnerable until some key moments late in the film, when we see that he acts very differently when he's all by himself. Right from the beginning of this film, gender expectations are brought to mind in the opening narration. We hear a voiceover from Peter, and he talks about the death of his father and his decision to remain at home. He remarks, "What kind of man would I be if I didn't take care of my mother?" Director Jane Campion also does much to undermine Phil's idea of masculinity in the film. One of the first times we see Phil, he's marching into town to the saloon with a group of men who work with him. And with the amount of swagger in his walk, he clearly thinks he's the coolest guy around. But the way this scene is shot tells a different story. We, as the audience, can see that he actually looks pretty ridiculous in his elaborate cowboy gear, walking down the street like a king. It's an early clue that Phil's masculinity is, in many ways, performative, and that he lives his life putting on a front to hide his own insecurities. And so it makes sense that when he sees someone less traditionally masculine, like Peter, who is happy and comfortable with himself, Phil can't take it and has to make his life hell. Another key aspect of Phil's character is his incessant nostalgia. He spends much time looking back, talking about the good old days when there were, quote, real men. He also idolizes his old mentor, a man called Bronco Henry, and never stops telling stories of how great and tough Bronco Henry was before he died. As the film goes on, his tough persona unravels to some degree, and he actually develops a friendship with Peter that defines the second half of this movie. Much will be made of Benedict's performance in this, and it's very strong, but the standout for me was Kirsten Dunst as Rose, who finds a real joy in her love with George, but whose happiness slowly deteriorates because of Phil's constant negative influence on her. The most devastating scene in the whole film involves Rose and a piano performance, and the enormous weight of expectation she feels after joining this new family, and Kirsten Dunst handles this and all of her scenes really wonderfully. Visually, this film is a real treat. The beautiful mountains surrounding the Montana ranch are constantly in the background, and the camera takes time to linger and really let us take in the beautiful landscape. Speaking of lingering, the pace of this film is pretty slow and intentional, which works well for a character study like this, allowing us to sit and reflect on the choices Phil makes as we slowly begin to understand and even feel some empathy for him. And I'll also mention the great score by Johnny Greenwood. It's beautiful, but at times very discordant, which helps define the unique tone of the film. The only of Jane Campion's other films I've seen at this point is The Piano, which I like a bit better than Power of the Dog, but I have a similar complaint for both, and that's the writing of dialogue. It's pretty uneven in both films. There are moments in The Power of the Dog that are really brilliantly written, but there are also a few moments that are pretty bad. Benedict's character, Phil, speaks with a lot of country colloquialisms, and there were a handful of times I felt the script was a little too countrified, and it ended up sounding pretty hammy. And ultimately, that weakened Benedict Cumberbatch's performance for me. Not that his acting has any real issues, but some of the lines were so cheesy that even a pro like Benedict couldn't make it sound natural, and it really took me out of the film a bit when that happened. Ultimately, that's a pretty minor issue in what is otherwise a very strong film. The family dynamics explored are really unusual and interesting, and it features great performances all around. By subverting and deconstructing the macho masculinity of the film's protagonist, writer and director Jane Campion seems to want to heal real-world divisions. I certainly didn't expect to empathize with a character like Phil, but we all know people like him in real life. The insidious ways that Phil bullies people definitely feels familiar as you watch it happen on screen, but by the end, we see his character with new eyes, even with some degree of understanding, which begs the question, why can't you do the same for real people in your life? I gave The Power of the Dog 4 out of 5 stars. You can see it in theaters now, and it hits Netflix on December 1st.
For what kind of man would I be if I did not help my mother? I did not save her.
Sort of a lonesome place out here, Pete. Unless you get in the swing of things.
Do you like popcorn? Silly question. You're listening to a movie podcast. Of course you like popcorn. I love popcorn, and I love trying different ways of making it. But I run into an issue. Stovetop popcorn tastes amazing, but it's a lot of work. You have to get your pot, your oil, do all the seasonings yourself. Microwave popcorn is much easier, but typically it's not nearly as good. Until now, I recently discovered a product that completely solves this problem. It's called OPopPop, and they make flavor-wrapped popcorn kernels that give you premium popcorn quick and easy from the microwave. OPopPop even comes with its own special popping bowl that ensures your kernels pop perfectly every time, and it comes in a variety of tasty flavors like vanilla cake pop, Maui heat, salted umami, and fancy butter. Don't worry, they have variety packs, so you can try them all. If you're a popcorn lover, it's perfect for you, and it also makes a great holiday gift for the movie lover in your life. I'm a big fan. I've been eating it a lot, and you can get 10% off your first order right now if you go to arthousegarage.com/popcorn or click the link in the show notes. All right, back to the show.
Autumn in New York.
I keep seeing these ads for that zombie show on TV. It's awful. I can't believe people want to watch that kind of stuff at night. You know, there's enough going on in the real world to give me the creeps.
Great. Thank you.
Autumn in New York. To the Blake family Thanksgiving.
To the very special Chinatown edition of the Blake family Thanksgiving.
Here.
Dad, you won't get any reception up here. You have to lean up against the window. Yeah, but no. Lean in. Smush your body up. There you go.
So, are you balancing a job with all your studies?
The main reason I'm not done with school yet is because I was depressed for a bit. I'm fine now.
In our family, we don't have that kind of depression.
Dad. Whoa, come back to Earth.
Sorry.
No, we just have a lot of stoic sadness.
Can't you hire someone to...
Cost $100 a night to hire someone to make sure she doesn't fall
in your bed.
No, she needs to think before she opens her mouth.
Don't you think it should cost less to be alive?
Absolutely.
There aren't just a ton of Thanksgiving movies out there. Apart from holiday specials like Charlie Brown Thanksgiving, I can't think of many. I can think of a few films with Thanksgiving scenes, like Rocky or Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and I can think of movies that have kind of a Thanksgiving vibe. The movie Dan in Real Life, for example, has always felt Thanksgiving-y to me, but there's actually no mention of Thanksgiving in the film. Well, the new film, The Humans, which you just heard the trailer audio for, from A24 and director Stephen Karam, is a Thanksgiving film through and through. The entire film takes place in a single location on Thanksgiving Day as the family gathers in the new apartment of Bridget, played by Beanie Feldstein. The cast of this film is incredible. Bridget's partner Richard is played by Steven Yeun, Amy Schumer plays her sister, and Richard Jenkins is incredible as her father Eric. I was previously unfamiliar with Jane Houdyshell, who plays Bridget's mother, Deirdre, but she gets a really wonderful performance also, and then June Squibb rounds out the cast as Momo, Bridget's grandmother, who suffers from dementia. That's the entire cast, and they rarely leave the bare apartment, which doesn't even have furniture yet. They eat their Thanksgiving meal from fold-up card tables and drink from disposable cups, and her parents comment frequently on how shabby the apartment is and the problems she'll have there. It's essentially a chamber play, and in fact, the director, Stephen Karam, adapted the screenplay from a stage play, which he also wrote. And it's a simple film, at least on the surface. It's essentially all dialogue, with these few characters interacting, discussing, debating, even fighting, and bringing up family drama. The writing is really meaty and touches on all kinds of things: generational divides, trauma, romantic relationships, breakups, aging, mental health, financial struggles. Bridget's parents don't understand why she would spend so much to live in a rundown old apartment in New York City when she could be much more comfortable living in their hometown of Scranton. And the sisters Bridget and Amy similarly struggle to grasp the mindset of their aging parents with their baby boomer concerns. But the film manages to give basically equal weight to both sides of every argument. The characters are so well written that you empathize with everyone. What I haven't mentioned yet is the thing that sets The Humans apart from similar family dramas, and that's the incredible sense of dread hanging over the entire film. After a few minutes, it feels like you're watching a horror movie, but it's unclear exactly what's so horrific. The camera doesn't do the things you expect. It's very still and mostly just lets the drama unfold, but it also pauses to examine things like pipes, the unusual noises they make in an old building, or water damage in the walls and the ceilings and the grotesque shapes it can leave over time, or, most nerve-wracking of all, shadowy figures in the windows of nearby buildings. It all feels like it's leading up to something mysterious and horrible. As the film goes on, the anxiety builds both from the sense of dread created by the camera and sound design, and in the rising tension between the characters whose discussion around the Thanksgiving table becomes more and more emotionally fraught. Old friction resurfaces and some new things come to light, and all the arguments that unfold are performed in a naturalistic, down-to-earth way that becomes increasingly painful to witness. It's a real panic attack of a movie, and I mean that in a good way. I was very impressed by how affected I was by the end of this film. The sense of dread becomes existential, and thematically, the film gets to an almost cosmic place, making the film's title take on a new, grander meaning. So yes, it's a Thanksgiving movie, but it's also sort of an anti-Thanksgiving movie. It's not a feel-good story by any means. The one movie I could compare it to is the Trey Edward Schultz film Krisha, which is another Thanksgiving drama with some horrific undertones, though the two films are distinct in many ways and stylistically very different. Ultimately, The Humans is refreshingly authentic, and it's a real joy to see a group of uber-talented actors like this take on such an incredible script. Richard Jenkins really shines here, and it's also great to see Amy Schumer in a serious role, which she completely nails. The conflict between Beanie Feldstein's character and Jane Houdyshell as her mother is also really something to see. It's as fascinating to watch as it is uncomfortable. So, this film isn't for everyone. Don't put it on for the group on Thanksgiving night thinking it's a light family film. But as a piece of dramatic filmmaking, it is absolutely top-notch. I was very impressed with it, and it's worth a watch any day of the year. I give The Humans 4.5 out of 5 stars, and it hits theaters this Wednesday, November 24th, just in time for Thanksgiving.
There's this comic book I was obsessed with as a kid. It's about this species of half-alien, half-demon creatures and the scary stories that they tell each other are all about us, humans.
I know you think there's something wrong with me. It's not a news.
She still acts like a martyr, but I'm trying to apologize.
You'll find someone new. You're going to come out of this stronger. I promise.
Stop. Don't actually stop.
Anything I say makes her.
Yeah. Who should remind you?
You.
Me.
You.
It's you, my friend.
I love that in times like this, I have a home base, a family I can always come home to.
To knowing this is what matters, right here. Because everything anyone's got, no matter who you are, everything you have goes.
Well, that's a positive way of looking at things.
Wow. Do that at a funeral, Dad.
Well, awards season is upon us, and that means there are lots and lots of movies coming out. With that in mind, I'm going to start a new segment called What Have You Been Watching Lately? I do this with my guests sometimes, but right now I'm watching so many things that I'm going to start doing it solo. Essentially, I don't have time to give an in-depth review of everything I watch, but I do think these things are worth talking about. So I'll run through some other films I've seen lately and give a brief reaction to each. Some of these might also get a full review later on, especially if they end up getting nominated for any big awards. So let's do it. Here are a few of the things I've been watching lately. These first three I watched in connection with the AFI Film Festival. AFI is the American Film Institute, and they have a pretty big festival each year in LA. I've been aware of AFI Fest because they show some pretty big movies every year, but this was my first time participating. And like with so many other festivals lately, I went virtually. A handful of the titles played virtually, so I was able to watch them from home, and here's what I watched. First up is a film called Holy Emmy. This is a really fascinating film directed by Araceli Limos, and it's her feature directorial debut. It tells a story of two Filipino sisters who are living in Greece, and it's very spiritual in nature. I actually did a whole review, written review, on the website, which I will link in the show notes. One of the sisters, Teresa, becomes pregnant at the beginning of the film, and the other sister, Emmy, was born with some unusual supernatural powers. The film really looks at sisterhood and spirituality in some haunting and unusual ways. There are some pretty horrific scenes, and smartly, it's not exactly clear what Emmy's powers are at the beginning of the film, but we learn, as it happens, exactly what she's capable of. The pregnant sister, Teresa, attends a Catholic church, and she becomes more and more devout as the film goes on, while Emmy joins a community of faith healers and learns to use her powers for good, in a sense. It's a very unusual film, very grounded, and feels very realistic, and so it's really surprising when those supernatural things happen. But I found it really fascinating, and the ending is pretty astonishing. I gave Holy Emmy 3.5 out of 5 stars. Next up is a film called Paris 13th District. This is from director Jacques Audiard, and it's a French film. It's a relationship drama, basically young people living in Paris and their intersecting love lives and the drama that unfolds with that. It's very, very well acted. It has Noémie Merlant, who you may know from Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Also, Céline Sciamma, who directed that film, helped write this film. There's some interesting things going on here. For one thing, her character, who's Nora, bears a striking resemblance to a porn star and is mistaken for her. And because of this, ends up striking up a friendship with this porn star. And the relationship that they grow is really surprising and interesting. It's a very stylish movie. It's got cool music. It's shot in black and white. It's a very sexy movie as well. Ultimately, I liked it, but didn't love it. It didn't come away with anything that felt very significant, but it is about kind of the younger generation and how love lives are different now than they used to be. I gave Paris 13th District 3 stars. And speaking of Céline Sciamma, the next film, Petite Maman, is directed by her. And it's hard to talk about this without spoiling the central surprise of it, but it is about a little girl who has just lost her grandmother, and she and her parents moved to her mother's childhood home to clean out their old belongings. It's a really amazing performance from Josephine Sans, who plays Nellie, the main character, and about a third of the way through the film, she makes a friend from a nearby home, and the nature of that friendship is the thing I can't spoil, but it's really, really incredible. This film is incredibly minimal, maybe no music at all, the camera rarely moves. But I love a movie that's very grounded in reality, but has a sort of a magical realism thing happening. And that's, without spoiling it, that's what's going on here. And it ends up exploring family ties and mother-daughter relationships in ways that are really surprising and unexpected and so beautiful. It's a really lovely movie. I came away just feeling so warm. It's interesting. I didn't cry while watching the movie, but then I cried while telling my wife about it, about what it's about. So I don't mean to tease too much, but I also don't want to spoil what's going on in the film. But I did give this film 5 stars out of 5. I really, really connected with this. And that is everything I watched through AFI Fest. I'm so glad that I was able to attend virtually. I really enjoyed the things I watched. Next up, I watched Squid Game, the Netflix show that is sweeping the nation, and I mostly really liked this. I do think, so here's an interesting thing. I was pretty into this show. I thought the concept was cool and well executed, as we learn about all these different characters. There is, towards the end of the show, I won't spoil anything, but some VIPs show up, and when the VIPs arrived, it was such a shift in tone, and I felt that the writing and the acting of these VIP characters was very bad, like in contrast to everything else about the show that is so great. And I just had such a strong reaction to it. I was like, my wife and I were watching it together, and I was like, can you believe how bad this acting is? What's going on? And I was then listening a couple days later to Slash Film Daily, a podcast I really like, and they had a similar reaction to those characters. And Huai Tran Bui, who's one of the critics on Slash Film, explained that that's actually a common thing in Korean dramas to have characters who are from the West be really bad actors. I don't know. That was news to me, but I was like, well, I guess it's in that tradition. But I did think, like, I wish they could have written around this in a way that would have made it stronger. But what do I know about Korean dramas? But I did end up really liking it, and I'm curious to see where they go with season two. Squid Game is now playing on Netflix. The next thing I watched, back to the world of film, is something called Shiva Baby. This came out earlier in the year, and I remember hearing some buzz around it, and I really, really, really like this movie. It's a comedy. It is about a young woman named Danielle who is coming of age in a way and is just struggling with a lot of things. And I did not know this, but the whole thing takes place in a single location. I actually watched The Humans, and then I watched Shiva Baby in the same night. Two films that take place in a single location, and there's a lot of like claustrophobic feelings, which that was not intentional, but kind of interesting. But it's a kind of a cringy comedy. She, in the opening of the film, is hooking up with someone, and then you see that person pay her, and it kind of adds a new layer to what's going on. She then goes to this Shiva for someone who she didn't really know, and she's there with her parents, and who would turn up but the person she was hooking up with, along with his wife and child. And so the drama inherent in that is very strong. And really the performance by Rachel Sennott, who plays Danielle, is so, so good. She anchors this thing. There's so many close-ups of her face feeling so many uncomfortable emotions in a way that's really funny, but also heart-wrenching. And this movie really surprised me. I did not expect to cry at the end, but I did. Also a really good performance from Molly Gordon as Maya. Diana Agron actually plays the wife of the love interest guy, and she's really great too. I haven't seen her in a while in anything, but I was really impressed with her. And then Fred Melamed plays her father, who I always love showing up in different comedy things. That is Shiva Baby. It is streaming on HBO Max, and I gave it 4 out of 5 stars. Next up is another thing that's kind of in the zeitgeist right now, which is All Too Well, the Taylor Swift short film. As far as Taylor Swift goes, I'm a fan of hers. I'm not a huge fan of hers. I don't spend a lot of time reading online discourse about her or that sort of thing, but I like her music. But I couldn't avoid the discourse around this and how much drama online about breaking down who it's really about and what things symbolize within the song and the film and all of that. And I tried to not get into too much of that and just take this film for what it is. And I really liked it. I thought it was well-directed, especially well-acted by Sadie Sink, who plays the character Her, the woman in the film that's sort of a stand-in for Taylor Swift. And yeah, I thought it was very well-acted. I like the extension to this song. I do think this is one of Taylor Swift's best songs. So if you're a Swift fan, you're going to love this. If not, you might not care about it, but you can watch it on YouTube. Next up, I watched a film called Spencer. This is from director Pablo Larraín, and it stars Kristen Stewart as Princess Diana. This is a film I was really looking forward to, and it did not disappoint. I really, really enjoyed it. Kristen Stewart's performance is incredible. It's so, so good. This is a really intimate, uncomfortably intimate portrait of a person who's has having a real mental health crisis for some time now, and it focuses on just 3 days around Christmas time when the drama was just kind of setting in a way, and it's very harrowing and haunting, and it goes in some places I did not expect it to go, but it really, it looks at the ways that society scrutinizes women in ways that it doesn't scrutinize men. And it also kind of looks at the whole system that is the monarchy in England and how absurd it is in some ways. And I think it does a really good job, too, of showing sort of the invisible forces that were putting so much pressure on Diana. And like, I really understood, I think, for the first time, the pressure she was under, because it's not something that's immediately clear just from, reading headlines or something. And I also like that the film takes time to show her joy as well and how she really does love her sons in the film. And it's a really a beautiful movie, tragic in a lot of ways, very well directed, a must see, I would say. Not an easy film, but I would say seek it out. Kristen Stewart's performance is enough of a reason to watch it. But then you add in Pablo Larraín's fantastic direction, and this is a really, really great film. I gave Spencer 4.5 stars, and it is now playing in theaters. Next up, a film called Belfast, directed by Kenneth Branagh. This sort of tells his own growing up story as he's a child in Belfast in Northern Ireland. And it's a stylish film. It's mostly in black and white, but the color comes in at key moments in a way that's kind of interesting. It's very much a sort of a love letter to the city of Belfast. And it tells the story of kind of working class families' concerns. So we have Jude Hill is the young actor who plays Buddy, which is sort of the stand-in for Kenneth Branagh. His mother is played by Catriona Balfe and his father by Jamie Dornan. And the relationship between his mother and father is a key part of the film that brings a lot of the drama that affects their whole family. We also have Judi Dench and Sirian Hynes as his grandparents, and they're actually probably my favorite characters in the film. All in all, I think this film is really well made, but I did have some issues with it. I thought it was a little overly sentimental. There were some script moments that I thought didn't work that well. And I think some of those choices that are a little out there that writer-director Kenneth Branagh goes for don't completely work. And a lot of the drama ends up feeling a little bit manufactured. Another issue I had with it was I thought the music was, not that it was bad, but it did not fit the tone very well, I think. Not only the score was fine, but maybe a little weird, but the soundtrack music, which is by Van Morrison, I really thought didn't mesh with the rest of the film in a way that was really distracting and took me out of it. That said, there are some really nice visuals in this film. I think most of the performances are really strong, and I know a lot of people are really going to love this, and it seems honestly like an Oscar bait kind of a movie, so I imagine it'll be part of the conversation going forward. That is Belfast. I gave it 3 out of 5 stars, and it is now in theaters. And finally, a film called Undine, or Undine, as they kind of pronounce it in the film, which is a German film by director Christian Petzold. It tells a story of a woman named Undine, who is played by Paula Beer, and she has just gone through a breakup at the beginning of the film. Actually, it opens on a breakup scene, and then from there, it follows her as she finds new love and goes in some kind of mysterious places. Something I did not know going into this film, which probably would have helped me to appreciate it better, is that the word Undine refers to a German fairy tale about a water spirit, and that would have clued me into some of the fantastical elements that come up in this film. Even without having that context, I really enjoyed this. I appreciate that it has a lot to do with architecture and city planning about the city of Berlin, which is not something you get in film often, where architecture comes into it or the history of a particular city. But that was a big part of this, and I really enjoyed that part of it. It kind of feels academic in that way. But then the romantic relationships, I think, work really well also, and the performances are really nice. I gave Undine 3.5 stars, and you can watch it now on Hulu. And that is what I've been watching lately. Let's turn now to today's discussion. On the last episode, we started a new series, and we continue it today. It's called The Art of Deconstruction: Faith, Doubt, and Film. In this series, my guests are people who grew up with a particular religious affiliation, but have changed later in life. I was inspired to do this because it describes me as well. I grew up in an evangelical Christian environment, but am no longer evangelical. But I'm still a Christian. Each of my guests are selecting a film that they relate to on a faith level and telling their story before diving into the film with me. Today's guest is Chad Hill, a friend and filmmaker you may recognize from his previous appearances on this show. I met Chad because of his short film, Invitation. It played at Filmland a couple years ago, and it's a film with some religious themes that I definitely identified with. In fact, Invitation is available to watch online now on Chad's Vimeo page. I will link that in the show notes so you can check it out. I quite like it. Chad selected the film Silence, which is a missionary epic from director Martin Scorsese, starring Andrew Garfield, Liam Neeson, and Adam Driver. Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver play Portuguese missionaries in the 17th century who go to Japan to find their old teacher, played by Liam Neeson. At this time, Japan was torturing and killing Christians, much of which is depicted in the film. Like last time, we do get into spoilers for the end of the film about halfway through our discussion, but we do give a spoiler warning at that point. And I'd love for you to hear Chad's thoughts before we get spoilery, so if you haven't seen the film, I encourage you to keep listening now and tune out when you get to that point later. All right, here is my discussion with Chad Hill about Silence.
Our Lord said to them, "Go ye into the whole world and preach the gospel to every living creature."
Ferreira is lost to us. He denounced God in public and surrendered the faith.
That's not possible. Father Ferreira risked his life to spread our faith all over Japan.
It seems to me that our mission here is more urgent than ever. We must go find Father Ferreira.
This is in your hearts, then, both of you?
Yes.
Then I must trust God has put it down. The moment you set foot in that country, you step into high danger.
Welcome back to the podcast, Chad Hill. How are you today?
Hi, I am doing pretty swell. How about you?
Doing very well. We were chatting before recording. I'm moving soon, so I'm currently surrounded by boxes, so my house is a big mess. But doing really well, staying busy with all of that. And you're staying busy with some film work, yeah?
Yeah. So almost a month ago to the day, I decided to go into full-time film work, and so I've been working in film pretty on some projects pretty much nonstop since. So it's been tiring, but it's been very, very rewarding and exciting and scary and all of the things all at once, you know.
Well, that's very exciting. Best of luck with that, and kind of going out on your own in a way. That's really great. I was excited to have you on for this topic. So you were on before for Baccarat, which that movie was so great. And then the Obama movie, that was you, right?
Yes, that was
me, the way I see it. That's right. It's been a while. So this is your third time here, and I was excited to have you on for this series because kind of the way we met, and I've kind of recapped this before, but we met basically because I saw your short film at a film festival. And it was a short film that had to do with religion and faith. And that's kind of how we initially connected and then realized we had a lot in common in that area. So I'm so excited to dig into a movie with you today. So kind of the first question I'm asking my guests in this series is to kind of, as much as you're comfortable with, tell us about you and your faith and kind of where you started, where you are, and just, you know, however much detail you want to give about how you got where you are.
Yeah, so I've grown up in the South my whole life, specifically Louisiana, and I was raised Southern Baptist, and my parents took it pretty seriously. Like as a kid, like I was very much like I was very into it. I was a true believer. Mm-hmm. I was a good kid, you know, like was into, you know, following all the rules and, you know, doing what's right, and I, and everything. And over course of my time, I don't know, is the kind of thing where it's hard for me to pinpoint exactly when it happened. I feel like there was probably some tension that was always there just from the way that I was and my personality, and my way of being, that was very compassionate and very empathetic and very sensitive, to the people that kind of clashed with, didn't quite mesh very well with some of the doctrine and some of the hardline theology that I was being taught and was given as a kid. And I guess it was the kind of thing that it was always there, but I never really thought too hard about it until I had grown up, until I had been in college and, you know, really gotten into film and experienced a lot more things, met a lot more people. And really around 2015, 2016 was the first time that I really kind of realized that maybe, I don't think I believe in the same faith that my parents do, you know, that my family does, that I was given. And it's not to say that I'm not a Christian anymore. I still identify as a Christian, but it's just, it's been kind of difficult sorting things out. Like, I think where I am right now is a place that's pretty unorthodox, and it's kind of hard to say whether or not there's any kind of denomination or line of thinking in America right now that really kind of fits with what I feel my faith represents.
And that's something too that, like, I think took time for me to realize that that's okay, you know, because growing up it's like, oh, you gotta have, you know, an affiliation, and like, you know, here's the right and the wrong, and kind of throwing that whole system out and realizing I can believe what I want to believe, and like, yeah, that's a bigger conversation, but yeah, I feel you on that, and I definitely feel some commonality as far as like, I think the way you put it about like the hard line theological issues, that's where it ended up being. There was so much friction between the way I wanted to live my life and the way that I wanted to show compassion and kindness to people. And eventually just realized that this isn't working, and had to, you know, make a change. But yeah, it's interesting too about like, there wasn't necessarily a particular today's the day that I decided, you know, it happens over time, and it's a gradual thing. And I kind of told a brief version of my story last time on the previous episode, but so much for me was, you know, and now I can look back and see where there were seeds of doubt about these things that like I didn't even realize were there. But now seeing where I am now and being able to look back, like there was a through line, and these things were always there in an interesting way. So yeah, thanks for sharing that. That's really interesting. And it's, yes, also being in the South, it's not an easy thing to do to kind of differ with the majority culture in a way. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Yeah. Well, this is a film podcast, of course. So I have asked all my guests here to also select a film that's kind of been meaningful to you on a faith level. So tell us, what film did you select, and tell us a little bit about the film.
Yeah. So as soon as you brought this to me, there's one movie I immediately wanted to talk about. And this is Silence, the Martin Scorsese movie from 2016. Mm-hmm. I think I mentioned earlier that 2015, 2016 was really kind of the time frame for when like the sudden recognition and the sudden started really kind of exploring and thinking about my faith very seriously happened. And this movie almost like came in right at the exact right time for that. The other thing for me, growing up in as a Christian and being a Christian that really loved movies and really loved film, was the recognition that like a lot of Christian movies suck. Like, they're just bad. and not just for reasons of like filmmaking quality, but just like I felt like very few of them like were taking things as seriously, you know, taking the faith and the theology and what they were actually saying and putting out there seriously in a thoughtful manner. And then this movie comes along, and I literally, like, I just, you know, was sitting in the theater watching it, and I should say this movie came out, I think it was like a limited release, whatever. There's a theater near me that finally got it, and literally the second weekend it had one showtime. Like, it was playing once every day.
Catch it while it's here.
Catch That's it while it's
here. It. Cinema life.
Yeah, catch it while it's here, and I'm so glad that I did. I actually went back and saw it twice in the theater, I think.
Nice.
Because like, this is just the kind of thing, like the film, you know, for those that don't know, we'll go over what the film is about. It's it's an adaptation of a novel by a Japanese author. I can't remember the name, but it was actually previously adapted by a Japanese filmmaker back in the 70s. I've seen that version also. It's also very good. But this was one that coming from Scorsese, you know, Scorsese, while he was making The Last Temptation of Christ in the 80s, while he was exploring that, he was handed this novel, and he loved it so much, he sought out, he wanted to make it. And so this was like a kind of a 30 years in the making passion project for him, where it really, so it, the basic outline is explores the journey of these two Jesuit priests in the 1600s who travel to Japan to spread the gospel. But they're also searching for their mentor, another priest who had traveled to Japan years and years earlier, who they had heard rumors had apostatized and had denounced the faith. And this was particularly a time period when the Japanese government and the Japanese ruling class was really, there's a lot of persecution of Christians in Japan at the time, and there was a lot of great suffering, and they were really adamant about trying to stamp out Christianity. So it's just this very dangerous journey. It's a very, I think, very tough mission that they see themselves on. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. over the course of the story, these priests kind of have their sense of their faith and their mission and what they are doing and whether or not they're any good, doing anything any good for these people, challenged a lot, because it's very directly about what does it look like and what does this mean to suffer for the gospel, to spread the gospel, and what does this actually look like in practice. Mm. And it is just, like I said, like, you know, growing up in the church, I was used to watching a bunch of Christian films that were basically kind of prepackaged sermons, you know, were, you
know, come with an agenda.
Yeah, they come with an agenda. So either they have like a specific, like they're like calling out something they're against, like, you know, something specific that's happening politically, you know, in the nation, or they're delivering some kind of very prepackaged, safe and affirmational message about, you know, getting your marriage back together or loving your neighbor or, you know, doing some kind of act of charity or whatever. That's, it's nice, but it's very safe and very and very
surface
distinctly
level, maybe.
Yeah, very surface level, and also very distinctly like middle class American in their concerns, in their day-to-day life. And so I came and sat down in this movie, and suddenly, like, it was like water for the soul of just like the sudden seeing this filmmaker, and suddenly recognized, like, oh, this is someone who is also taking this seriously, like I am. They are thinking about these things in the way that I am. They are conflicted and have doubts, and it was just like, it was so refreshing and it was so meaningful, you know, on the surface level, just to experience that and see that someone was doing that. Mm-hmm. But as over time, it's just become even more meaningful because of, I guess, what it actually has to say about faith and has to say about the experience of God.
Yeah. It's a film without easy answers, I would say, like, you know, in opposition to most of those, you know, quote unquote Christian movies. Mm-hmm. And that's funny too, that, like, you're talking about like the middle class American audience for that. When you say Christian movie in that sense, it's a very particular kind of Christian they're targeting. And of course, then that gets into, you know, commerce and marketing, and like, that's just so icky. But anyway, but yes, this movie, it's a lot more ambiguous, and it's got, yeah, there's so much doubt in it, which I think is so interesting. So just a couple basics about it. It's directed by Martin Scorsese, and it stars Andrew Garfield as the main brother Rodrigo, and Adam Driver. And then Liam Neeson is the person that they are trying to go find. That's, you know, supposedly apostatized, that they're trying to track down and figure out. And he also was like their mentor. And so it's very upsetting to them when they hear the rumor that he has given up the faith. I guess we can kind of get into details now. Are there particular things about this film, or what about this film do you find particularly meaningful for you?
Yeah, so I think the first thing, obviously, is, I mean, it's kind of in the title. So, like, you know, the idea of like being able to experience and hear God, and, you know, hear directly from God. Like, I mean, prayer is something that, like, is a obviously going to be present in a film like this, but it feels like it's a very direct theme of the film mm-hmm. and a direct focus that we are privy to Father Rodriguez, which is Andrew Garfield's character. We're privy to hearing his prayers and his thoughts as voiceover mm-hmm. throughout the film. And at first it starts like it sounds like he's writing letters, you know, to back to his priest, but it becomes pretty clear that he's praying, he's talking to God mm-hmm. at this time. And as the suffering gets more and more intense, as more and more people die, as he is forced to go into, you know, more and more treacherous situations, and his prayers become more urgent and more desperate, the fact that, like, you know, you, like I said, it's in the title of the film, the silence of God, is just asking, like, where are you? What are you? You know, like, what am I doing here?
Yeah,
I need to hear something from you, and these people need to hear something from you. Why are you, you know, why are you being quiet? There's at one point while he's praying, he asks the question of just like, am I just praying to nothing? And a lot of times growing up, like, you know, that's something that that's something that I always felt, like, to this day, I even still feel like I don't really know what it feels like to actually hear directly from God. You know, in my prayer life, which was something that whenever I described to, you know, my parents or to like a teacher, seemed completely alien to them. I was like, what are you talking about? How do you not, you know, and it's, or they didn't really have a good answer for it. They were just like, you just have to have faith, or, you know, they would give examples about, I know my mom in particular would say, that she, you know, she would hear answers of prayers, not necessarily like a voice calling to her, but usually she would pray for something and then there would be something like a song that comes on the radio or something just in her life, like in her immediate vicinity, would kind of happen to affirm that, whatever her prayer was, and that would give her peace, and that would be like her answer for God. And I have never experienced anything even remotely close to that.
Yeah, I remember those kinds of discussions too when I was younger. Like, I'm remembering this on the fly. Like, I didn't know this was in my brain kind of thing. But I remember, like, thinking, like, okay, can God actually talk to people? Like, how does that work? And basically over the years, never really getting a straight answer about, like, what that's supposed to mean to hear from God. But, like, hearing things like that, like what your mom's experienced, or just like, I guess different people's experience and what they think it is, you know, and it just never, it was one of those things like, I guess I'll just stop asking and this, accept this is how I'm supposed to live my life. Right. But to see that really reckoned with in a film like this. And it ties back to the previous film we did, Winter Light, last time with Andrew Bocock. And there's so much in that film about God's silence, and especially his silence in the face of suffering, and that, and the problem of evil and kind of all of that. It's really interesting.
Yeah, but it also meant so much to me. Like, you know, I almost don't want to spoil it. How spoilery?
Yeah, I think we can hold out until we are ready to spoil it. I mean, if you want to spoil it now, I think we can do that. So, spoiler warning if you haven't seen Silence. But like last time, I think this is a film that, even if you know the plot points, it's still kind of an experience to watch it. So take that for what it is. But if you want to go in unspoiled, tune out now.
Okay.
All right. Let's go ahead, spoiler wise.
Yeah. So, I mean, just on the theme, like, again, like dealing with the issue of God's silence throughout the film, you know, the biggest thing, like the most emotional moment of the film to me is the moment near the end when you actually finally do hear God speak. And the message that he delivers, you know, there's two times that we actually do hear the voice of God supposedly in the film, and they're near the end, and in both cases they are not exactly what you would expect to hear in that circumstance, and they kind of go against a lot of the ideas that I was fed about, like, Christian suffering being, and what it means to be a martyr, you know, what it means to be a Christian. It's like, no, I will not denounce my faith, I will not give up my faith, you know. There's the whole, you know, I don't have memories of Columbine, but I do have memories of kind of the stuff that was in the cultural Milieu, you know, mm-hmm. at, you know, shortly thereafter, you know, we're in the talk, the story of, and I can't remember her name, but the student who, you know, the urban yeah. legend of the student who
I want to say it's Cassie Bernal or something.
Yes, yes, that's right. You know, Cassie Bernal's story where, you know, someone came up to her, you know, one of the shooters came up to her and asked, like, do you believe in God? And she said yes, and supposedly, you know, she got killed because, you know, she didn't give up her faith. And, you know, so mm-hmm. that's an example to aspire to. And this film almost directly just calls out that as complete bullshit. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. and the circumstances are a little unique, but the way that it also does it really undermines a lot of the Christian martyr complex and persecution complex that I see, where it really punctures the idea of Christianity being the end-all be-all savior, of being the healing of suffering, because and that's something that's directly reflected in the character of Father Rodriguez in the film, because throughout the film he is kind of identifying himself very directly with Jesus. Like, he's drawing direct parallels to how his story is reflecting the journey of Jesus Christ, you know, to the cross. Even visually, Scorsese draws comparisons to that. Like, I think about whenever he's first being brought to prison in Nagasaki, he's ridden into town on the back of a donkey. There's a lot of other parallels that are drawn throughout the film that associates him and what he is doing with, you know, the holy mission of Christ. And I feel like the film very directly punctures that, you know, by the fact that, like, you know, the Japanese very quickly learned that, like, you know, they can kill as many Christians as they want, and that's only going to make it worse. You know, that's going to feed that martyr complex, and it's going to feed that persecution complex. But if you can show the priests and the leaders that what they are doing is causing these people suffering, like, that you're going to spare them and force them to watch what the consequences of what they're doing, that is going to be a lot more effective to and really challenge that sense of, like, is what you're doing here good? You know, and that's not to say that what the government was doing to these people was not evil. It absolutely is, 100%. But that's another aspect of the film that I think I hadn't really given too much thought before, but how all of this, you know, the story that I've been fed, you know, in my upbringing was that, you know, the world's going to hate you just because you're a Christian, and you're going to be persecuted just because you're a Christian, and stuff like that. And really, this film kind of shows that, maybe you could say that, like, Christianity is specifically, like, what is being targeted, but the government specifically has, like, national, like, foreign policy reasons for not wanting Christianity in the country because of how missionaries and Christianity is used as a tool of colonialism, you know, a lot of places, of bringing Western influence and bringing and spreading empire. And I think it makes sense for a government to look at that and say, no, we're not going to tolerate that.
I love all the scenes between him and the Inquisitor, who is, like, his performance is so great. The Inquisitor guy.
It's a wonderfully, like, I don't know, delightfully doesn't feel like the right word, because it's just really monstrous, but he's also like, just the way that he carries himself is not what you expect from, like, this imposing figure. Like, he's very, I don't know, mischievous.
Which makes comical sense.
Which makes sense, because the actor that plays him is supposedly, I'm not familiar with any of his work in Japan, but apparently he's like a comedic icon in Japan, and so that's some very, I've been told that that's some very sly casting done on the part of Scorsese, putting him in that role.
That's very interesting. I didn't know that. He's very funny, and they have so many great discussions about, you know, here's why we can't allow Christianity to be here, and like you're saying, if we just kill the Christians, that only makes it worse because of the martyr complex thing, so we have to have them apostatize, and and kind of make an example out of them. And yeah, all that. So there's a conversation they have, which, so this is like problematic on a number of levels, but he says that Christianity is like the being plagued by the love of an ugly woman, like the way which is so funny and obviously sexist and all that. Like he's a bad guy, but
right. It was a different time.
Yeah, the way they discuss that is so interesting though too. And he's like, so you're saying that that's what the missionaries are like? And he's like, yes, exactly. And it definitely made me, you know, want to research more about like the political situation at the time and stuff, because it really was power concerns. Like, he lists Portugal and three other countries as like foreign policy threats to them, like you're saying, which, and that, so that brings in the parallel, like my own story with around 2015, 2016 and just that election that happened here in America, mm-hmm. and kind of the blinders coming off about the religious right and how much of this is about power and that sort of thing. And yeah, so that's kind of reflected in an interesting way here in the film as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I had a couple notes about just like the whole idea of missions and stuff and kind of the cultural understandings of things. So interesting fact is that I spent some time overseas with a Christian organization. So this mm-hmm. kind of hits home in some ways. But there was so much in the film about like, Japanese culture, like Christianity just doesn't work with Japanese culture. It's kind of like, it doesn't take root here. It's not useful here. Which, you know, I think if I watched this movie back when I was deeply evangelical, I would have been like, you know, that's because like, that's not the way you should be looking at faith, right? It's not a tool. Mm-hmm. But then you kind of zoom out and you see actually both of these countries are kind of using their faith as a tool. So there's that, but then also, just like, yeah, the colonizer aspect of it. And there's the way Rodrigo, Father Rodriguez experiences that is he questions early on. I almost wonder if these people care more about the iconography than the actual faith, like when he's giving them like little crosses and things like for them to hold on to and hide and like cling to. Mm-hmm. The exact quote here is, I worry they value these poor signs of faith more than faith itself. But how can we deny them? He's like, what else am I going to do? But then when he ends up connecting with Liam Neeson's character, he basically explicitly says like the Christian faith that Japanese people hold isn't true faith. Like they can't understand the basis of it that we, you know, we Europeans understand perfectly. And so literally none of these people are actually Christians is mm-hmm. what he's trying to say basically, which right. is so interesting. I remember hearing things like that when I was, you know, training to go overseas about, I remember hearing things about like, well, every culture has, you know, 80% of can hold on to 80% of its own culture, but you have to have 20% of like an 80-20 rule of 20% of like, okay, these things don't mesh with Christianity, so we have to change them. And like now I can look at that and say, okay, yeah, that's completely colonizing and saying let's intentionally take away part of your cultural identity for this faith that we know the right answers, and so we're gonna come and give you these answers.
Right. It's very yeah. it's very calculating. It's very paternalistic, and yeah, it's not great.
Yeah, pretty interesting stuff. But and so where Liam Neeson's character gets to, like they say early on, like the rumors that he's apostatized, he's denounced the faith, and now he is, quote, living as a Japanese. And that is kind of the case. He's really embraced Japanese culture when they meet him finally. And
it's an interesting performance, an interesting character, because it's unclear. I mean, I think based on what he says, there is some genuine disillusionment with his faith mm-hmm. there, but it's hard to say how much of it is authentic to him and how much mm-hmm. of it is imposed on him by his captors, you know, because he's essentially mm-hmm. being held a captive, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and being, you know, forced to do these studies in writing. And so it is a fascinating performance once he shows up. He's a figure that kind of hangs over rest of the movie, even yeah. though you don't meet him until like the last half hour. But he's, once he comes in, he he complicates the question even further.
Yeah. And it's so interesting that he has become like, now he's writing a book to help debunk Christianity. Basically, like he's a big old evangelical in a sense,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
In that context, and that's, of course, that's horrifying to Father Rodriguez. And yeah, the just that when he shows up, it's really kind of electric. It's like, oh my gosh, we're finally having him here, and like the dynamic is so interesting. It really like brings some energy when Liam Neeson shows up on screen.
One thing I want to circle back to something you talked about when you were talking about the, you know, the iconography and the symbols and I think Scorsese is such a, this is why he is a legend, because like I think the way that he plays with religious imagery and symbolism in this movie is brilliant and fascinating and so thought-provoking, because I mean, like you said, you know, he has the moment where he's handing out the little crosses and he's breaking up his rosary to give out the beads to people because they want them. They're so hungry for something tangible to hang on to that represents their faith. And, you know, he starts to kind of ask, you know, like, you know, do they actually have faith, or are they just like putting their faith, like they're worshiping these idols, basically, which is kind of a paternalistic instinct. But it's also, I mean, kind of genuine. But I think the film challenges that visually, that, I mean, essentially, I think Father Rodriguez is doing the same thing, because early in the film, we hear his prayer and we're seeing him getting ready, you know, to go on this journey, and, you know, at night, and he talks about, you know, speaking to Christ and seeing, seeing him, you know, his face looking lovingly. And then, you know, there's always the question of how, you know, whenever a film's going to deal with faith and maybe bring up the question of God, if you're going to depict God, how might you do it? And I think Scorsese does the most interesting thing, is that he chooses artistic imagery to do that. And so like whenever, like we see what Father Rodriguez is picturing in his head when he thinks about Christ, like who Christ is in him, and it's a painting. Like it's a painting that he saw as a child, and that ends up being the stand-in for Christ for him and for the audience for the rest of the film. And I think that's, you know, it's a useful, you know, from a filmmaking standpoint to identify exactly, you know, like what is this going to look like to the audience so that we recognize it. But I think it also, it demonstrates so much like that the same, he is essentially doing the same thing where he is not, when he is picturing the things that he holds valuable in his faith and the things that he worships and looks up to, they are not, he's not thinking about the actual God, you know, being or whatever. He is also thinking about the imagery and the iconography and
I didn't think of that.
And the symbols that he was given and looks up to. And it's a similar thing of the question of how much power do these symbols actually hold? Like they are not God, you know, they are not holy or anything, you know, it won't hurt anything to actually step on it. But because of the power that they have over these people, it makes it even harder to denounce your faith by stepping on a plate, you know, or spitting on a cross or whatever. And and I think that's further, I love when that painting comes back later in the film, you know, when he is kind of in the middle of his roaming the wilderness, you know, after everything's gone to crap, you know, and he's drinking out of the stream, and he looks at his reflection and his reflection starts to merge with the Jesus painting, you know, and he's already drawn a parallel to himself and Jesus's journey. And that just kind of further like demonstrates his savior, you know, his savior complex and his martyr complex that he has. I think it's brilliant.
So. You're so right. I just remember too, there's like multiple times in the film when, kind of what you're talking about earlier, where he's praying and he's like, why is God silent? And then he experiences something that he considers to be a sign. Like at one point he sees a bird when they decide to go outside. And it's funny because like they see the bird, and he's like, oh, this is the right thing to do. And then they almost get caught. And so maybe this wasn't the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And then later he prays and then he finds a fire that has just been burning. And, it seems like that gives him hope and he feels like that's an answer of some kind. But yeah, and the question can always be there, like, this is, you can see this as, oh, God sent him a sign, and that's how he seems to be seeing it. But you can also see it as he's reading meaning into things that's not there, which is, I guess, the big question about faith all the time is how much should we bring to it and call God and say, oh, that God has sent me something, but really it's within us, then we're following our own intuition and calling it God or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's a lot of what it feels like sometimes, that people are kind of ascribing meaning to, human beings, their habits, the way that our brains are wired is to identify patterns and identify cause and effect. And so I think that is a lot of what does end up happening, is that just, a natural occurrence of events or small things are just ascribed this great meaning out of cause out of nothing,
And that's kind of related to, so that moment when he, is finally, is he going to step on the plate or not, towards the end, and we finally do hear the voice of Christ seemingly. Do you read that as like, this is in his head, or how do you think about that?
It's something that I go back and forth on it a lot, because I think like it's extremely meaningful, because there's a part of me that wants to say that it's not in his head, that is God speaking to him, because I personally would find it really meaningful that, like, so in that moment he is being asked to finally apostatize, to spare all, in order to spare all these other Christians who are suffering and who have already done everything that they can to try to appease the people and prevent their deaths and prevent their suffering, and they have decided that no, it's up to you have to do this, and if you don't do this, they're gonna die. I just feel like what he hears the voice of God telling him in that moment is the most Christ-like example in that moment. And so I want there's a big part of me that wants to believe that really is the voice of God. But there's another part of me, there's another part of me that knows, and this is getting into the further, like, of the religious iconography and the religious symbolism and how steeped our perception of all of that is in our upbringing and our backgrounds and where we came from. The actor that plays the priest, like their priest that sends them out at the beginning of the movie, Ciarán Hinds, I was trying to remember his name. Ciarán Hinds is the voice of God.
Oh, really?
In this film. Yes. He's the two times that God speaks in the film. He's voiced by Ciarán Hinds, which I don't think is something that's credited, but that's what they did. And so knowing that further complicates that question.
I think this is just his boss's voice in a way.
Right. Exactly.
In his head.
Exactly. So, I go back and forth on it quite a bit. But it's interesting to consider, because I don't know, it's so impactful in that moment either way, just because, like, I think I genuinely believe it was the right thing to do, that the voice of God was telling him to do, and whether it was something imagined or whether it was the real deal, it is genuinely the most Christ-like, the most self-sacrificial, most humble thing that could have been done in that moment.
I like that too, and I think so. I mean, you can see it also as like, this is Scorsese saying, here's my statement of faith, or whether it's from the original novel, I don't know. But yeah, in a sense, you can read it as like, lay down your dogma and care about people, in a way. That's kind of as I started framing it in my brain, is like, he's so caught up in like, I have to do the right thing. But they're like, people suffering, you can help. Like, that's way more important. I like that aspect of it as well. I love the ending of the film and how it goes into this journal entry of a guy who came upon them, the two apostatized priests, or I can't remember how he terms it, But yeah, that's such an interesting thing to have this third party suddenly observing them and what the rest of their lives looks like. Mm-hmm. They, you know, take on families and spend their lives like rooting out Christian iconography, basically, and like almost being watchdogs or police. Mm-hmm. But then there's always this question of, is he still holding on to some Christian faith? And they make him denounce over and over and over mm-hmm. the rest of his life, which is so interesting too.
Right.
And then the very final shot of the film is complicated too, because we zoom in on his mm-hmm. his body that's burning, and he's yeah. as he's after his death, and he's clutching to this cross yeah. even though he's been silent about it for, you know, decades at that point. So yeah, it's yeah. a really memorable ending.
And that's something I'm also not sure if it's in the novel. I know that it's not in the 70s film. The 70s film is generally a way more agnostic than this film is, and kind of where it ends is like basically once he once Father Rodriguez denounces his faith and is given his family, like it just kind of implies, you know, ends on this series of freeze frames that kind of implies that he's just in this state of suffering and despair. And so it's a very dark ending the original film has. But this one, I have to believe that this is the Scorsese touch, you know, the whole yeah. ending segment. And I think it's great that, you know, once he renounces his faith, we no longer get the direct access to his journey
yeah,
in his life.
That, yeah.
You
know, like he's not said, praying anymore, whatever. Yeah.
Right. The third part, you know, we have the third party who is, you know, we're getting this journal entry from. And Scorsese also complicates it with, you know, you have the tension because, you know, we're being told the one thing that's, you know, this third party observer is telling us, you know, which also is not just his observations, but also what is kind of being circulated in Japan by the government, by people that live there and stuff like that about Father Rodriguez. But visually we're also seeing his life play out. And even though we don't have that internal direct access to him anymore, we are seeing his life, and we can see mm-hmm. where what is being said about him is deviating from what we're actually seeing. And it's kind of, you know, it's, I struggle with the question about like, what does it mean to live a good life, to have true faith? Mm-hmm. And you know, does your faith mean anything if you're not, you know, if you're not doing something with it, if it's just yeah. for you and it's just internal and it's personal? And I think that's something that this film, the ending of this film, does affirm, that, you know, the only person that can affirm anything about your faith and whether it's real and what it is, that's between you and your God or whatever mm-hmm. being you worship, you know, or report to, you know.
Yeah, and so like he apparently was, you know, silent about his faith for so long and still was clutching on to something, and then yeah mm-hmm. that's bringing him a God, and like I think I like that ending too.
Yeah and that's the thing that I don't know, like I've tried to, so over the years, like I've tried to like convince, you know, some more, maybe not necessarily like fully like evangelical Christians or whatever, but you know, people who are maybe lean a little more conservative, who maybe don't think about a lot of this stuff as hard as you and I might. You know, like I had a coworker who was looking for movie directions, recommendations, and I suggested he watch this because I really loved it and I thought he might appreciate it. And he came back to me and he was just like, I don't see how any Christian would like that movie. And similarly, I remember, you know, I got into a conversation with my parents about Christian films and stuff like that again, because they had just seen the newest Kendrick Brothers movie or something, and were just aghast that I didn't like it, you know, or whatever, and didn't care for it and had problems with it. And so I just tried to give them as an example. I told them about this movie and I could tell that they were never going to watch it, you know? So I just kind of walked through the whole plot, you know, of the film and told them, like, this is what this means and this is why it means so much to me. And they were just, like, kind of baffled, you know? Like, just like, that sounds terrible and that sounds really depressing and, like, not affirming and positive, you know? And, you know, how can that be Christian? You know, how can that be, you know, whatever? And I'm just like, but it is, you know, it's like honey for my soul, you know, it's,
yeah,
I don't know.
Really good movie. So this is my second time watching it. I told you this just in a text the other day, but like the first time I watched it, I had watched a bunch of movies right before it. I was really tired. I had to do it in multiple sittings with interruptions, and I feel like I missed so much of it. And I was like, I really need to give that another chance. So I'm so glad that you chose this because yeah, sitting down and like really giving this the attention it needs, and probably where I am in my life now versus last time I watched it. Yeah, really, really meaningful and so much to latch on to. And another thing I wanted to mention too was he has a great conversation too with, there's like an interpreter guard that comes in maybe two thirds of the way through, and like their whole dynamic is so interesting. But
I love that interpreter. It's so like
my favorite characters.
Yeah,
the conversation they have about Christianity and Buddhism, and he's like, well, you don't understand Christianity. Well, you clearly don't understand Buddhism. And like the just the back and forth they have is really great. I guess it's like right after he gets captured. I like that as well.
Yeah. I also love, Adam Driver is also in this film.
We haven't even mentioned
him. Yeah, we haven't even talked about him because he does kind of disappear from the movie for a little bit. But when he comes back, I think is really great also, because I think there's a tension early in the film that Father Rodriguez is generally kind of maybe a little more compassionate towards towards the locals, towards the Japanese people that there's in.
Like a stronger faith, it seems, or something.
Yeah, it seems to maybe have a stronger faith, but Adam Driver's priest is a little more like, he's more hardline about the doctrine, because like there's a point where like they're, you know, doing a baptism for a child, and the parents ask a question that's like clearly shows that their understanding of something kind of basic is incorrect, and rather than just kind of nod and, you know, be very gentle with them about it, he basically comes out, snaps at them, and corrects them, you know, on what it is. And then, you know, later on, whenever they're talking about, you know, the Inquisitor and some of the government people are coming to the town, that, you know, because they know that there are Christians and they're gonna, you know, take some people away, and they're talking about, you know, what do we tell these people to do, like, you know, when the time comes, you know, is it okay for them to apostatize and save themselves? Father Rodriguez says yes, it's okay to trample on the icon, and Adam Driver's character says no, don't do
absolutely
that.
Absolutely not. Yeah,
absolutely not. That's evil. And then it's interesting to see that come back, you know, once he does come back into the film, where, you know, at this point, Father Rodriguez has been captured and he's kind of been parade around, and he's kind of been made clear to him that, you know, they're not going to kill him. They're going to, you know, he's basically meant to be a witness to what they're doing.
You know, make an example out of him.
An example. And so they bring him to this beach to watch the execution of some other, you know, some Japanese Christians, you know. And what he doesn't know, what they don't tell him until he shows up, is that Adam Driver's character, and I keep saying that, I forget his name,
I'll look it up really quick.
That anyway, that Adam Driver is going to be there.
Father
Garupe has been captured, and at this point he's been gone for like 2 hours in the movie, you know, like
because it's a long movie.
they split up and they separated. So Father Garupe is also there. He's been captured, but they haven't, you know, he hasn't been given the same treatment as Father Rodriguez, and in fact, like they've straight up told Garupe that Rodriguez has already apostatized, and Garupe doesn't know that he's there either. And so Rodriguez gets to watch helplessly as, like, they basically do the same thing to Garupe, where they tell him, you know, like, you know, these people are going to die unless you apostatize. And rather than apostatize, I don't know, it's so conflicting what he ends up doing, but I think it's so indicative of character, maybe a little bit more compassion, maybe a little bit of a stronger faith and conviction, that rather than apostatize and rather than simply be captured, you know, and remain a captive, he swims out into the ocean and dies with with
like tries to save
the Christians.
Them
and he dies, tries yeah. to save them and dies, and it's tragic, but it's there's something. It's hard for me to sort out my feelings on it because it is beautiful and horrible and just everything all at the same time, and it really. Yeah. indicates something different about, like, you know, his faith, you know, even though, like, yeah, he was more of an asshole when he was he was stricter and maybe a little less kind with his theology and his thinking. Mm. Inevitably the result was something that was maybe more compassionate and more, you know, like Christ-like, and that he chose to go out and suffer with the people, you know. Mm. rather yeah. than, you know, hold on to his pride, you know. It was sort of like a way that he got the martyr's death, but it was in a way that was genuinely self-sacrificial, you know, rather than just the something of just being prideful, you know, and in the way that Rodriguez seems to have bought into and be seeking.
Yeah, it's a really incredible scene, and in general, performances across the board are, I think, really, really good in this. Driver,
they're all phenomenal.
He's like emaciated almost. I read something about how much weight he lost before the film and then during the making of it, and just like he's so thin and it's like really weird to see. But then Andrew Garfield is incredible too. Like, he really carries the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Well, so that is Silence. That is streaming in a few places. I watched it on Hulu, I think, or something like that. You can find it online. From 2016. Really, really great film. It is kind of a long film. It's 2 hours and 40 minutes, which is part of why I had to break it up the first time I watched it. But I would recommend sitting and giving it the full attention for the full time if you can. There's so much. And one thing I did want to mention was just there's so much that overlaps with the previous film too, with Winter Light, just about God's silence and it's suffering. And like, there's actually, we didn't even mention this scene, there's a really tough scene where the people in one of the villages are killed, and they're hung on crosses while the tide comes in. And it's like, that's probably the hardest to watch scene, I think, in the film. And where Winter Light talks about, you know, this kind of ethereal suffering, here in this we see it happen. And so, like, when we see him praying about, you know, why did you let this happen, God, like, we saw it too. It's like we get it. So I don't know, I think it's it feels very Martin Scorsese in that way, maybe, that it's gonna like not shy away from some of the more brutal sides of what's going on, but then kind of bring it all full circle. So yes, good movie is what I'm trying to say. Great very movie. Much recommend it. Yeah,
and I would also recommend people, you know, if they watch this, maybe also check out the earlier adaptation from 1971. Yeah. That's Masahiro Shinoda directed that one. It's a very different film. I think its stance and its sensibility is very different from this one. Like, this one, it's more positive despite all of the horrible things that we have described in it. I think that's one of the beautiful things about it. I think we're allowed to have things be complicated and uncertain and maybe even doubtful, but also still end up being hopeful, you know? And I think that's something that, like, that's another disconnect with a lot of, Christian, quote, you know, capital C Christian media, is that there's a pressure for everything to be completely positive, be, you know, everything is great, you know, we're gonna, you know, even when they're not great, you know, they can easily be solved, God's got everything, you know. And I think it's important to validate those kind of feelings and issues and stuff that maybe are more difficult and are darker and harder to sort out, and then still come out the other end in a in a place that is hopeful. Anyways, so that's this film. If you want to be sad, go watch the 70s version. It's also very good.
I was gonna say, I looked up the name of the author as well. It's Shusaku Endo, a Japanese writer. So yeah, I'm really curious about that I think what I've just found is a podcast comparing the adaptation of the film to the book to the film. So I'll link to that. I haven't listened to it, but it sounds like it would be interesting. There's a couple of film critics who have read it. So, well, that's Silence. Thank you so much, Chad, for coming on the show to talk about this. Thanks for sharing some personal details. I'm just so appreciative. And I think it was a really great discussion.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me again.
So grateful to Chad for coming on the show. He's such a thoughtful guy, and I loved hearing his thoughts. And that will do it for this episode. Stay tuned to your podcast feed for next time. The plan is to review Don't Look Up, the new film starring Leonardo DiCaprio, Jennifer Lawrence, Meryl Streep, and a bunch more people. If you haven't heard about this one, check out the trailer. I'll drop it in the show notes because it looks like a lot of fun. I'll also have a review of the new film from director Paolo Sorrentino, The Hand of God. It's an Italian coming-of-age film, and I'll go ahead and tell you, it's really good. I'll drop that trailer in the show notes also. And for the next film in the Art of Deconstruction series, I'm going to discuss the 1996 Lars von Trier film, Breaking the Waves. I've actually not seen this film yet, so I'm excited to check it out and then discuss it with Michael Darty. He is the co-founder of the Real Abilities Film Festival, which is, quote, the largest festival in the U.S. dedicated to promoting awareness and appreciation of the lives, stories, and artistic expressions of people with different abilities. I can't wait to talk with Michael, and I'm excited to share that conversation with you. And with that, thank you for listening to Arthouse Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes, and you can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. Learn more at appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, leave a rating or review in your podcast app, or you can buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter by going to arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search @arthousegarage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob free.